Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Our speaker, Dr. Zachary Abuza, was brought to Australia by the Australian Israel Jewish Affairs Council. So, special thanks to Colin Rubenstein and Robert Clarnett. The topic for the night's discussion is militant Islam in Southeast Asia. Dr. Abuza is an expert on a number of areas, but we thought we would ask him to talk about that. He's got a book just recently released within the last day or so called Muslims, Politics and Violence in Indonesia, published by Routledge, and there are other books he's published as well, and we've got notes there. If anyone wants to buy them, we can order them for you through Janet Grundy's organisation. He's the author of Militant Islam in Southeast Asia, Renovating Politics in Contemporary Vietnam, Political Islam and Violence in Indonesia, which I just mentioned. Dr. Abuza is also a writer, a commentator, an author, of course. We've seen him a fair bit in Australia. He appears on Late Line as well as other television sites in Australia, but he's associate professor of Simmons College in Boston, and it's his first visit to Australia and his first talk in Australia. So we welcome Dr. Abuza to talk on militant Islam in Southeast Asia. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Henderson. Thank you very much for coming. It's a real honor for me to be here, and I can't tell you how pleased I am to finally be in Australia after all these years. I've certainly have friends and colleagues that I've worked with in the past few years and got to know more, but some have never made it, and nothing happened. I remember days after the first tragic Bali bombing, someone from the Australian embassy called me and said, "We need you in Australia, we'll try to make it happen," and typical bureaucrats never could make it happen. This man did, and so I definitely owe Colin Rubenstein a great deal of thanks for getting me here. There's a lot to talk about, and certainly it is right now everyone's a little bit on tenterhooks because it is bombing season in Indonesia. And I think there's a lot of good news about what's happened there. And this is hard for me to come out and say because I'm just a natural-born pessimist. You know, most people see the glasses half full. I see it as half empty, cracked, leaking, teetering on the edge of the table. And it's just my nature, and you're not going to change me. You can try. The Australian enthusiasm is just—it's very infectious. But I'm pretty resilient to that. The good news is, there have been more than 350 arrests around Southeast Asia, and not just Indonesia. About 300 in Indonesia alone. There have been 250 successful prosecutions. Whether you like the rate or of the sentences, or people have been sentenced long enough, or the remissions, trust me, I'm very concerned as much as the Australian public about those events. But the centralized command and control of JI, what it was as an organization in 2000, just in 2001, the back has really been broken in that, and its capabilities have clearly been degraded. There are other bits of good news. From a human rights perspective, this has happened across Southeast Asia. I was just expecting every poor person wearing a skull cap to be thrown in jail. And the human rights situation in terms of the war on terror really hasn't been that bad. I mean, if you were bracing for the worst, it's, you know, what's happened in Indonesia has happened in the context of a very successful democratic transition. And we need that. We really do need that. We also have much more operational intelligence and understanding of JI, and there's also been a lot more international cooperation. Governments that just were unable or unwilling to talk to one another are talking, and I think the Australians deserve an inordinate amount of credit for that, especially after the Bali bombing of 2002. The Australian intelligence and police have really taken such a lead in the region and served as an important bridge between the security services of Southeast Asia that still tend to withhold information and are suspicious of one another. So there's a lot that you can say is quite good in this situation. Now, let me just give you some bad news, and bad news in general, because this is, of course, what I focus on. In some sense, there is a degree of complacency that JI has been eradicated and beaten. And this will certainly impact the international cooperation within Southeast Asia. That sense of urgency is, you just don't see it in any country you go to in Southeast Asia right now. The second bit of bad news reaction is, whenever you go and you're talking to the Indonesians and Malaysian governments, you're always going to get this knee-jerk reaction that it's about Islam. And that, there's just no way we're going to overcome that right now. There's such a defensive chip on their shoulders every once in a while. And, you know, they do have very legitimate concerns about other issues. I think there's growing public pressure on the regimes to not cooperate as much. Whether you're talking about the growth of Islamist politics in Indonesia or Malaysia, the power. In many ways, these groups, though they're quite small, really are setting the agendas. And the tail wagging the dog phenomenon in Malaysia and Indonesia, certainly that the moderates are often playing catch up. Moderate Muslims are increasingly fewer in number. They're still the majority in these societies, but in too often, especially in Indonesia recently, they've been cowed into submission in many ways, whether it's the power of the Islamists to issue the fatwa, to mobilize the thugs to march in front of the jail offices, to ransack a midya, mosques, or to stop churches or other minority houses of worship from being erected or, you know, people able to practice. This is a real concern. And I'm very, very concerned that the moderates just aren't standing up enough. No one seems willing to really expend the political capital to really call the Islamists. And then you see it in Malaysia too. Another bit of bad news is I don't think we've even seen the blowback from Iraq yet in the region. And at one point, something's going to happen in Iraq. I don't follow it. It just depresses me so damn much. And I'm so busy with Southeast Asia. But, you know, when even the U.S. intelligence community is talking about the cause célèbre of the international jihadists, the good news for Southeast Asia is you're not seeing those Al-Qaeda Middle Easterners coming into the Maluku's or Central Sulawesi or Mindanao the way you did. The bad news is they will come back at some point. And they certainly are much better skilled and are going to come out in larger numbers. I think there are also difficulties in that we're victims of success. Because that centralized command structure of JI is broken down, you have a much more horizontal organization. There is debate whether it is factionalized or not. I tend to think that the debates, whether it's factionalized, are a little overblown, and I'd see it more as breakdowns in just sheer command and control, how different cells are able to communicate once you had that top tier of leaders taken out. There are other problems, and let me just take you through Indonesia and the Philippines to illustrate some of the points I'm trying to make. The first is that in Indonesia, you've got a strategy that is based on decapitation. And the Indonesian police deserve great credit for their success in rooting JI and arresting individuals. But any decapitation strategy is a short-term fix at best. These groups will always be able to recruit and train and tap new leaders faster than they can be neutralized. And I think Indonesia's the clearest case in this. Terrorist organizations are social networks, And you have to be able to combat it in terms of it being a network or an organization. And I don't think anyone has really thought about that or is willing to countenance that politically in Indonesia. And that was really the subject of my op-ed today in The Australian. The main document that we have from JI is a document known as the PUBG. And it talks, it's a fascinating document to read if you ever have the opportunity. It's not an easy, you're not going to read it before you go to bed, but it's a fascinating document to read. And they talk about three stages for the movement. And that first stage is what they call faith or imam. The second is building up a base of operations, hijra. It could be a retreat. It could be a strategic retreat. And remember, if you go back and think a little bit about your Islamic history, the Prophet Muhammad himself had to make a strategic retreat from Mecca to Medina. Theologically, it's sanctioned. You can go underground. You can lie low. You can build up your strength. And there's no face lost in that. Strategic retreats are theologically sanctioned. And I think we often underestimate the time frame that these folks operate in. You know, in America, my God, the long term is a congressional cycle of 2 years. And I imagine it's the equivalent here in Australia. These guys are thinking the PUBG is talking and writing in terms of guerrilla warfare. They're talking about 30, 40 years out. And I don't think we've come up with strategies that are really thinking 30 or 40 years out. In fact, in America, there's no grand strategy to deal with militant Islam anywhere in the world. And the third stage they talk about is this jihad qital, fighting the enemies of Islam. I think they, in many ways, J.I. overstepped and rushed too far into jihad qital in the past few years. And what you're going to see is them going back and focusing on those first two stages that we saw. And building up recruitment and focusing on the religious purity of their members. And they're going to be able to do this through the mosques and madrasas that the government is not going to crack down on. They know there is a network of Abu Bakr Bashir's madrasas different mosques affiliated with radical alumni from these schools, but they're not going to shut them down. The Indonesians tend to think that if they can wean these people off terrorism, and if they're just simply involved in religious activity, that's not bad, and it's not dangerous. Well, I would make the case that those are centerpieces of recruitment down the line. They're thinking long-term, we're not. We also know that there's another very interesting JI document out there. It was written by one of the top people at large right now, Nordin Mohammed Top, and it was this 82-page manual about how to set up cells. And he defined a very loose horizontal cell structure. It's going to be very hard to combat. The good news is these smaller, more autonomous cells will probably be less lethal. They probably will not have the capabilities to put together large-scale attacks, but they're going to be much harder to root out and discover unless they're making mistakes. The next thing, going back to this idea of hijra or the strategic retreat, one of the things we're seeing in Indonesia really in the past few years, and it's something I try to get policymakers really to pay attention to, but they never seem to want to, is the sectarian bloodletting. In 1998 to 2001, JI was not blowing up buildings in Jakarta or targeting the West, not until about 2000. They were actively engaged in sectarian conflict, whether it was out in the Maluku's or central Sulawesi. This is where they got people to have that first taste of jihad, that first taste of defending their religion, going out and fighting, blood on their hands, they're part of the brotherhood, creating that Manichean worldview of us versus them. And then, of course, you had the government finally able to broker something called the Malino Accords, a very tender peace. And I spent some time out in Poso, couple years ago, and trust me, it was a very tender piece. But if you look at what's happened in the past 2 years, there is a systematic attempt to undermine the Molino Accords. And if you really look at the violence out there on a day-to-day basis and you put it all together, it's really alarming. I mean, everything from the beheadings of 3 schoolgirls to bombings. There were quite a few bombings in the past week out there. They're trying to stir it up again. And I would make the case that, you know, they're trying to make this region ungovernable, drive the government out, act as Islamist vigilantes, coming to the defense of Muslims that the state is not protecting. I think this is something that JI is going to put a lot of effort in the next few years. And that third way that I really see them regrouping and rebuilding is the subject of my op-ed today, and that's adopting a Hamas-style program. JI has never had anything like this in the past. There was always some overt side, but it was never a priority of the leaders. Right now, with people like Abu Jabril and Abu Bakr Bashir out of jail, and the Australians and the Americans and Singaporeans putting so much pressure on the Indonesians to get them back in jail, you know, there's very limited options for those men. They cannot engage in militancy. And so you now have Abu Bakr Bashir waging culture wars, pretending to be a holier-than-thou Muslim, and talking about half-naked women on the beaches of Bali is more dangerous than bombs. But they're actively engaged in charities. And charities and organizations linked to JI that really went dormant by late 2002, 2003, all of a sudden are all back up and running again. And I think that this is of great concern. The Indonesians, again, their idea is they can wean people off. This is not going to be a problem down the pike, and I completely disagree. This is part of that social network that you have to really understand. This is what facilitates it. A couple backpack bombs in Bali doesn't cost very much, but when you want to put together networks of madrasas and you want to build and spring in people for mosques and send 16 people off to Pakistan to study in Lashkar-e-Toiba madrasas, you start to put all that together and we're talking about real money. And I think that we don't understand the ways that by engaging in some of these charitable works, the JI is really able to move more mainstream and forge common cause with a growing number of Islamists. And frankly, people will no longer see them as the radicals that they are. These guys haven't given up their agenda and their goals. So those are some of the reasons I'm very concerned about Indonesia down the road. And yet I still give the government great credit. Whether we're going to see more attacks now, it is bombing season. I cannot tell you. We certainly know that from some of the debriefs of JI members in the past 2 years that Dr. Azahari, who was killed last November, really was determined to increase the tempo of attacks. He was very unhappy with that one attack a year and was trying to gear up to smaller attacks on a very regular basis that would keep society on edge and really impact the economy. And, of course, when they overran his safe house in East Java, what did they find? You know, 33 bombs are in various states of production. It was very clear that they were getting ready to do that. You might have noticed over the weekend there was a woman who was caught with about 9 kilograms of explosives. Again, they have the technology to do this, and I've seen some of Azahari's blueprints and bomb designs. They're very simple, very easy for people with even just a Quranic education to understand. So this knowledge has clearly been transmitted, and I think that this is something that they will be able to do. The good news is that with each attack, there are arrests, and the Indonesians, with considerable Australian assistance, have been able to really break apart cell by cell. But again, this is not going to be something that will be sustainable in the long run. There's another reason we also have to be concerned about JI. And that is, as long as they have this rear base area in the southern Philippines, they're going to be able to recruit and train and have the space to lie low. When you look at the number of JI leaders at large, and I'm just using publicly published numbers by the U.S. government, there are about 18 known JI leaders at large, which is of concern to anyone. That's not a small number. That's a real cadre of people with not only technical expertise, but quite a few of them are some of those with the closest links to the Al-Qaeda organization, were important money men. They're also important because they are across the socioeconomic spectrum and educational spectrum if you look at their profiles. But another reason for concern is at least four of those 18 are known to be in the southern Philippines. And this is a whole new can of worms because the Indonesians and Filipinos have quite different interests and capabilities in dealing with this threat. The Philippines, most of the JI people that were arrested in the past few years have actually been arrested in the tri-country maritime border area. And that's actually proved to be one of JI's big Achilles heels. The island hopping kind of from Indonesia's Nunukan into Sabah, into Tawi-Tawi, up to Holo, Basilan, Mindanao. There are real vulnerabilities there. And while the Philippines doesn't have much of a navy to speak, the Americans are there assisting them and trying to make up for that shortfall. And there have been some very important arrests of top JI leaders. And I would mention Zulkifli and Mustaqim arrested in Indonesia and Malaysia, irrespectively, who were arrested in this border area. And they and a few others, Romat and Taufik Rifki in the Philippines, have all made very clear that the training in the southern Philippines in Moro Islamic Liberation Front camps is still going on, albeit at much lower numbers. And no one's going to even pretend that we're at the levels of 100, 120 people at a time that was happening in the late 1990s. But the training is still going on, and the MILF is playing talking out of both sides of their mouth on this. On the one hand, there has been an attempt by a more moderate leadership that emerged after the death of the founder of the organization, Salama Hashim, in the summer of 2003. You do have a much more pragmatic leadership in Ibrahim El-Haj Murad. And he has, to some degree, served notice to the radicals within his own organization and within JI. There has been a restructuring of the MILF military component of the organization in an attempt to sideline some of the real hardliners. We'll see how long that lasts. There was reportedly earlier this year a coup attempt against Murad. I spoke to some people I've known in the MILF for many years, and they had trouble denying it. Obviously, there's growing dissatisfaction with how the peace process is drawing itself out. There's always been a concern within the MILF about a generational change, about a growing number of real radicalized youth in the movement. The other... he also served notice on JI and the Abu Sayyaf. And this is, the MILF clearly had the capability to arrest these individuals, and they didn't. But they served notice, and they're no longer in central Mindanao, and they're off in Holo running around with the Abu Sayyaf. And so hopefully even the hapless armed forces of the Philippines will be able to dispense with Dolmatan and Umar Patek and Gaddafi Janjalani, and that would be very important. But what people tend to forget is that those were the really radioactive people, and the people with names. There are many other JI personalities, and we know too, who are still in the heart of MILF territory. This is just a bridge that the MILF is not going to burn. They see, and I've talked to MILF officials about this every which way, and they'll deny that they're official links. They'll say they're personal ties. They've given me a dozen different excuses. But the bottom line, it's a very pragmatic choice. They don't have state sponsorship, and they have very low expectations of the peace process. And they're not going to cut their ties with the international jihadist community and potential funders, because the MILF is bracing for a return to war. They don't want it, but they're bracing for it. And it's hard to blame them. If you look at the history of the Philippine government's negotiations and willingness to implement what they've signed in the southern Philippines, it's hard not to come to that way of thinking that the MILF holds. The MILF is very concerned about a number of things, and too often we hear in the Philippine press, I cannot tell you how many dozens of times in the past year, let alone the past 3 years, how you will read reports where government officials say that there will be a peace agreement signed by the end of the year. And this has been going on for 4 years. They've been saying this. It never happens. This summer in the State of the Nation address, President Arroyo announced that they were 80% there. I don't know. I know I'm very cynical, but that last 20% is enormous, and I think it's much larger than 20%. There are major issues over disarmament. There are major issues over the land demarcation, subterranean resources. There are disputes over Sharia. There are disputes within the Muslim community itself between the MILF and the MNLF that no one has really thought about. I've spoken to the negotiators in Manila, and they paper over these issues. Their core belief, because they argue it worked with MNLF in 1996, get the MILF to sign anything, and they'll fall apart. Get them to sign, and then they'll fall apart. They'll squabble internally. They'll factionalize. Well, that never worked in 1996. All of a sudden, you had the MILF, which was a fringe group, all of a sudden emerge with a 12,000-man army, and much more radical than the MNLF. And if the MILF leadership just signs anything for the sake of it, you will get a split there too. And there are some real hardcore elements in the MILF. There are other reasons to be concerned about the peace process. And that is the peace process itself is going to be contingent on it two constitutional amendments. And it's really hard to imagine that President Arroyo, who came to office in 2001 in under dubious circumstances, People Power II, and then was embroiled in a vote-rigging scandal in the elections of 2004, survived one impeachment, who declared a state of emergency in February this year for a leftist-rightist coup. She couldn't make up her mind whether it was a left-wing coup or a right-wing coup. So it was a leftist-rightist coup, because in the Philippines, the left and the right have always gotten along so well. And, you know, she declared a state of emergency, unfortunately, on really exactly on the 20th anniversary of the People Power One revolution that ended the dictatorship. And then, of course, in August, she survived her second impeachment. The point I'm trying to make is she doesn't have the political capital to push through these reforms so easily. Last April, when they announced the real breakthrough in talks with MILF, I spoke to the MILF and I said, how long are you going to give the government to implement these reforms, these constitutional amendments? They said about 2 years. Well, it's been well over a year now, and they're no closer. And there is growing frustration in the MILF. And one of the ways that I actually look at this is last in 2004, 2005, ceasefire violations just plummeted. It was very encouraging. And then in the past year, the ceasefire violations have just rocketed. And maybe there's a lot of concern. And we also have to be aware that there are going to be spoilers on both sides. AFP is very against the concessions the government has made, and they're going to be unhappy with further concessions that the MILF is going to make. And a lot of MILF are very unhappy with the fact that Murad has come out and said, we cannot achieve independence at this time. That's a betrayal of the MILF's stated goals, and there are a lot of hardliners in that organization that are never going to countenance peace with the government and autonomy within the Philippine state. And on top of it, there's simply pragmatists in the MILF who have said to me, listen, in tropical battlefield conditions, our ammunition only lasts 1-2 years if it's stored well. Every day we're at peace and this draws out, our ability to go back and wage war declines. And so I think there's a sense that something has to transpire very soon because the talks in the past year have really gone nowhere. For all those reasons, you're going to have a JI problem because you will still have that base of support. And again, the MILF is actually quite divided over what to do with JI. But until you resolve that, they have no incentive to cut their ties. So I think I'd like to conclude there and field questions instead. I didn't have time to even begin to address the situation in southern Thailand, which is of great concern to, it should be to all of us. In conclusion, this situation, there will probably be an attack in Indonesia, but the situation is manageable. And I'm just so afraid of when governments go overboard and hype up the threats. I think that the governments really have to start to be able to think long-term down and it's just so hard for any government to really do this. These guys are thinking long-term. For some reason, I don't know why, I'm a big fan of Australian rugby. And, you know, it's the goal is to move the ball as far down the field in their lifetime. And that's what the jihadists do. You don't have to get the try, but you have to move the ball down the field. And these guys are totally committed and are going to keep at it. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Boozer. So we come to question discussion. As I mentioned earlier, there's some flyers there which tell you how to get Dr. Abuza's book through Janet Grundy. And so we come to questions and discussion, finishing no later than 7 o'clock, but see how we go, but no later then. Can I just ask the first question? In Australia, there's been some criticism about Abubakar Bashir's sentence. There's a feeling that he got off lightly, and yet, as you would know, and those of us in the room know, that in a sense the sentence he got for the kind of involvement that he was proven to have had wasn't all that light in terms of what would be the case in American law or Australian law. How do you view that kind of sentence and his current standing in Jakarta?
Well, I still think that his sentence was quite light, and with a remission serving 2.5 years, that was just a travesty, and in many ways, I'm more angry about the case of Abu Jabril, who has considerable blood on his hands and ended up in Indonesia serving around 4.5 months.
So give us the background to him.
Abu Jabril was one of the founders of JI, is a radical cleric, and he was really one of the most important figures out in the Maluku's and Sulawesi, and he put together one of the real radical paramilitaries called the Laskar Mujahideen. This guy has the death of thousands of people on his hands. He was eventually arrested in Malaysia and served in their internal security under that, was sentenced to about 3 years, or held for 3 years, never tried. And the Malaysians turned him over to the Indonesians. But again, the Indonesians couldn't link him to a bombing and so didn't address it seriously. And the guy is an absolute firebrand. I have video footage of him, you know, with his machine gun calling people into jihad. And this, I mean, he was a key link with some of the Saudi charities and some of the al-Qaeda figures that showed up there. I consider him to be a very dangerous figure, and he's one of the people I was writing about in the article today. His organization is really kicked up in the past few years, that was really dormant. His younger brother is the chief of Bashir's Mujahideen Council of Indonesia. So it's very well connected. In many ways, I think those of us who look at Indonesia have said that the portion of the government that's lagged behind in terms of reformacy has been the judiciary. You've had real reform in the political sense, in elections. The military has gotten out of politics considerably. It's the judiciary that seems to have lagged. And I, in some ways, I'm very sympathetic to the your position on this, that, well, for what he was tried for. I was in the courtroom for some of his trial, and it was just a travesty. I mean, what's justice in Indonesia? Well, traditionally it was the best money could buy, and for the first time there were the prosecutors had to go out and prosecute a case, and they did a terrible job. The line of questioning in the court was just abysmal. And so I think in many ways it was the prosecution's fault rather than the court's. But then the courts were certainly trying to exert their independence and say we're not going to be pawns of the Americans and Australians and wanted to chart an independent line. And I think in some ways it was important for their own development, even if I was unhappy with some of the outcomes. So that's important. Bashir is clearly under watch. The Indonesians certainly are attuned to the international pressure and displeasure from the Australians, especially, and the Americans. I don't see Bashir ever doing anything that would get him back in jail. But he's clearly watched. I think right now you really see him trying to rekindle the MMI and some of the different charities affiliated with that, and no one's really going to touch it. He's certainly been rallying people up for some of the spiritual, the campaigns out in the Maluku's and justifying the violence there, but always... He goes up to the edge. I mean, he's no fool. I've met him twice. He's shrewd. I mean, he's a good orator and he's very charismatic. But he's savvy. I think we do have a problem with some of the remissions. And I think the Australians were rightfully very upset earlier this year with the National Day remissions in which some of the Bali bombers were freed at this, you know, really at the same time that you have young hairdressers sentenced to outrageously long terms and dubious circumstances. Indonesia's got to take those considerations and deal with them a little more prudently. Australia is a very important ally for them, but there's just always such a fear of caving, being seen to cave into the West, the Americans or Australians.
Like Hezbollah, obviously JI rely on handing out money to communities to bring them in to their influence. We heard that the money in Hezbollah, is, a lot of it came from Iran, but where's the money coming from to JI?
JI has many different sources of funding that I've looked at. Probably they certainly raise money from their own ranks, and members were required to donate certain amounts. For the major terrorist operations, we know that money came directly from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and you can follow the courier trails and whether it was $33,000 for the first Bali bombing and then $100,000 that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed gave Hambali, carte blanche, you know, to use as he saw fit, which ended up for the Marriott and then probably left over for the Australian embassy. That money was coming in. A lot of money was coming in through some of the Saudi charities, and most particular the International Islamic Relief Organization and Al-Haramain. The Indonesian branches of the IIRO and the Philippine branch of the IIRO were just designated this August. The Indonesian branch of Al-Haramain was designated, I believe, in January 2003. But they simply scraped off the name and kept going. I went to their offices about 4 months after they were designated. They were still up and running. They hadn't been shut down. New accounts. So there are those ways. JI has been involved in different crimes, whether it's Imam Samudra and credit card fraud. Martin Chulov has, in his new book, has been writing about how they were selling phone cards, just petty crime, robbery. Interestingly, I have no evidence that JI was ever involved in drugs and anything, which is, you know, bread and butter in Southeast Asia for criminal enterprises. But they certainly also have wealthy donors from Saudi Arabia. One of the people that was designated this summer was a Saudi who was basically bringing in Southeast Asian radicals on Hajj and giving them briefcases of cash to go back. And so those the cash coming in, the cash couriers, it's really impossible to stop. Certainly, JI has used some local charities in Indonesia. I've written about some. Mercy, the medical emergency relief charity, is one that was linked to them. And the other is Compaq. The Indonesians will not touch either one of them. Certainly Compaq, which is actually an arm of the Dewan Dakwah, which is affiliated with the Muhammadiyah. So it's got very strong protectors. Again, those two organizations were very quiet in 2003. With the tsunami, you see them again. I'm working on a paper, which I hope I can publish soon, based on the Sydney, the Australian op-ed today, where I actually outline and go through what all these different organizations are going. They did use them in 98, 99, 2000, but it wasn't a cornerstone or it wasn't a priority of the leadership, but it always won them support. I think they're going to be gearing much more to that because it's very effective. They've watched the success of PKS and their good works. It's available for their leadership. The political leadership is encouraging them to do that. So I think we're just going to see a lot more of that in the coming years. I think we also have to be on the lookout that they're going to be setting up a lot of new charitable organizations that are going to be small that we're just not going to know about. And it's going to require very good financial intelligence, which is out there if the government's doing it. The first question is more one rather than the season in terms of the capabilities, personnel, money, manpower to put together these bombs. It simply took them an entire year to conduct a major operation. They just didn't have the manpower, money, or efforts, especially when they were all on the run, to have bombings on a more regular basis. It was almost 1 year apart between Bali 1 to the Marriott to the Australian Embassy to Bali 2. That's why we talk about the season. It's September, October. The second question, JI, the history of JI emerges out of the Darul Islam movement. Abdullah Sunkar and Abu Bakr Bashir became very frustrated with Darul Islam, which had a very quietist dawah focus on religion. Don't challenge the state. And they basically said, no, it's got to be an armed jihad. And so they formed JI really in exile in 1992, 93. They were in Malaysia at the time. And I think from there, that's about the time when you're getting, they served as a way station for some Southeast Asians off to Afghanistan. Not that there were a lot to Afghanistan, but it was the formative experience. And in fact, if you look at the founders of the Laskar Jihad, the Garagan Mujahideen Islamiya Patani in southern Thailand, the founders of JI, first-generation MILF leaders, you go through, their common experience was Afghanistan. It was the formative experience of their lives. So, you know, there was that. But then they simply put together JI as a network. And you have to hand it to JI. If they were founded in 92, 93, they did not engage in a bombing until 2000. And that, to me, is kind of a hallmark of maturity, that they patiently put together a real network. And one of the interesting things, we all know the name Hambali. He was an Indonesian off in Pakistan and Afghanistan at that time. He was not a warrior. He was not out in the front lines. There's no hagiography of him shooting down Soviet helicopters. The guy was a logistician. He got Southeast Asians in. He got them assigned. He got them out. He got them placed. And I think when they put him in charge of developing the network, I think you have to understand he had very good managerial skills. And so that's how the network grew. The controversial stuff and the things that really make people angry that I write about is this all took place in the fact that Islam in Southeast Asia has been changing over the past 30 years. And the reality is that there's a growing number of Salafis in the region. They're at odds increasingly with the Shafis or the Sufis. And there's a lot of Muslim-on-Muslim violence and conflict right now. In southern Thailand, where I spend a lot of time, I'm finishing up a book on the Thai insurgency. 60% of the victims in southern Thailand at the hands of the insurgents are fellow Muslims. And that's really troubling. They would always carry on. I mean, not until they create Islamic states in Southeast Asia. They certainly are inspired by or justify their actions because of externalities such as the Middle East peace. But, you know, I don't. If you have a Middle East peace process, a two-state solution, that's never going to satisfy them. It'll never satisfy them. And the Americans and it's you could have the Americans pull out of the entire Middle East as long as you had Murtad regimes, you know, regimes that call themselves Muslim but hold back the implementation of Sharia law. They would never be happy. Those externalities do matter. And, of course, it inspires them. It's good for media. And most importantly, it gives them the sense that Islam is under attack. But they still have, they would still find other reasons to justify their violence.
Is the Nation of Islam in America supporting this activity in any way?
I have no idea. I imagine that that you're talking about Louis Farrakhan's organization.
Yes.
I would imagine that the U.S. government is keeping very close ties on Mr. Farrakhan, but there are a lot of other organizations. You know, the Saudis have funded networks of charities and madrasas, and you know. There are organizations in America that have been directly implicated in funding terrorist groups around the world, including Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda. And so this is a real problem. I refuse to believe that poverty causes terrorism, or else Haiti would be the epicenter of world terrorism, sub-Saharan Africa. It's not. In fact, even in Thailand, people talk about economic underdevelopment in southern Thailand. No, the poorest place is the northeast, Isan, by far. The south isn't that far off. Of course it matters. The first time I interviewed Abu Bakr Bashir, it was right after the economic crisis, and he made no bones about it. He thought the economic crisis was proof that there was a Zionist conspiracy to keep Muslims poor. And, of course, there were a lot of underemployed and unemployed people. I mean, at some point, 40 million. That's twice the population of Australia that were underemployed or unemployed in Indonesia. They were just staggering numbers when you think about it. That's not good. That doesn't help us. But it's not a cause. I mean, there are radicals. You know, the number of militants that I've interviewed and basically have no concern for the economy, just say, Allah will provide. I'm thinking, well, I've got young kids, and, you know, it's hard to imagine that. I certainly want to see more development because development's a good thing, because, you know, we want to improve the social conditions, and because it takes away one of their grievances, but it's not going to stop it.
Taken a proactive role so far, and on the other hand, the extreme radical right appears to be gaining respectability. Do I conclude from that in your view, moderates in the Islamic movement and religion are not likely to be an influence which could change the direction of the terrorist movements?
I have such conflicted feelings about this. I really do. On the one hand, theologians and academics in Indonesia have made the greatest contributions in the world to the issues of Islam and human rights, Islam and democracy and pluralism, Islam and women's rights, etc. And there's such a great reservoir. You know, one of the things we'd love to do is be able to take those writings and translate them to Arabic and try to get them into the Middle East. Would be very important. The problem is Middle Easterners are so condescending towards Southeast Asians, they'd never read this stuff. No, they really wouldn't. But I want the moderates to stand up, and we have to understand that so many of the moderates are either scared because of the power of the fatwa or the power of the gangs who come and trash their mosques or siege their offices. Really, the Liberal Islam Network, these are our friends in Jakarta. I mean, these are our real allies. You have the Islamic Defenders Front come and put a couple hundred goons in front of their office. That's it. That's scary. Where's the state coming out there and cracking down on the Islamic Defenders Front and saying, this is unacceptable? State really wasn't there. There are other reasons. You know, a lot of moderates out there are afraid of being labeled puppets of the Americans. And especially when you have the invasion of Iraq, that really was a turning point. And you have to understand that a lot of people in the moderate Muslim organizations, not Ayatollah Ulama or Mohammedia, were at the forefront of criticism of the invasion of Iraq and that, and with some very good reason. So I'm concerned about that. But at the end, we have to accept the fact that Islam across Southeast Asia is moved to the right in the past 20, 30 years, and that it is different. But I still have hope for Indonesia because it's built upon such a rich indigenous foundation. And the other thing is they have tertiary Islamic education in the countries. One of the things that really bothers me about Thailand or Cambodia or southern Philippines is there's no place for them to go. They have to go to the Middle East if they want advanced religious training, and that does help radicalize them and change the nature of Islam there.
Well, one of the reasons communism failed seemed to me because people in the long run didn't really much like living in communist countries, and to get a choice, go somewhere else. And I just wondered if the same sort of thing, looking in the 30, 40-year span, people might want to join the modern world and have more fun and enjoy life more than just killing people.
Yeah, well, my cousin Henry turned his Bolshevik utopia in the United States, his chicken commune, and realized the land was very valuable and developed it and became the family's only millionaire. So I think there's something to be said for the appeal of communism. Cousin Henry has done quite well for himself. I come from labor Zionist background. There hasn't been a real backlash. And one of the interesting things, if you look at some of the public opinion polling, is that in Indonesia, one of the core groups, and you'd think, this is counterintuitive to me, because you'd think that women would be against the Islamists, because the first things, the canary in the coal mine for them is always the treatment of women, whether they're veiled, can they work, can they go out without family members, et cetera, et cetera. But women tend to vote for the Islamist parties in Indonesia and Malaysia because they tend to talk about things like drugs and teenage pregnancy and decline of morals and things that they're concerned about their kids getting involved in. And so I don't think we've really seen in Southeast Asia too many people living under the Islamists. There were two states in Malaysia under PAS. Now there's one due to not a rejection of PAS, but more an incredible political machine and gerrymandering that would make a Texas Republican blush. But there hasn't been a real there has not been a real backlash against the Islamists. You know, for the first time with decentralization in Indonesia, we now have areas in Indonesia where you have Islamist parties in control, they're governing. And I think the proof that you're really going to see is by 2009 when people see how well did they govern. You know, you go to places like Kelantan in Malaysia, it is not a rich place. It is decidedly the poorest state in Malaysia, without a doubt. But it's still not that bad. I mean, it's developed, and you just don't see this real reaction against it. I think they do understand you can go so far, and some of the call for Sharia and hukum hudud and cutting off hands and stoning of adulterers, I mean, some of that's just for public consumption, and they know it will never be implemented, and it's playing to the base, as we would say in American politics. If that started to get implemented a bit more, you know, when you start to look at the public opinion polling in Indonesia about Sharia and the ways people want some Sharia, but they don't want it all the way. Okay, he's yelling at me. Quick.
The final question, we're going to finish in 3 minutes. So, yeah, brief question. Is there any internal conflict between Sunni Shiite in the Southeast Asia?
There's so few Shia in Southeast Asia, it's not an issue. There really are. There's so in places like Bangkok, you get a Persian community. There's a Lebanese community there. It's so small. You would really have to look very hard to find Shia in Southeast Asia. But I have to say, you know, with the recent Lebanon war, a good friend of mine was in Malaysia at a dinner with PAS moderates. They were all fundraising for Hezbollah. So, and there's certain things that. One more quick question.
I just want to ask you a quick question about, we didn't deal a lot with it, and you're an expert on it. Southern Thailand, I mean, how serious is the situation in southern Thailand?
I'm very concerned. This has been off everyone's radar screen. It is a place there have been up to about 1,700 people killed in less than 2.5 years. I can't think of any place in the world other than Iraq where more Muslims have been killed. It's been terribly mishandled by the Thai government. But there are a few other things that really bother me about southern Thailand. The first is what I said before, the Muslim-on-Muslim violence. That, to me, is very indicative of the fact that it's a real clash between Salafis and the Shafis and Sufis. And it's really going on. The other thing is there is quite a bit of ethnic cleansing. There are Buddhist villages that are empty. I mean, empty. Buddhist wats down in the south that are just empty. You know, there used to be fairly good ties between the two communities. That's frayed, and I don't think you'll ever rebuild the trust, and that's going to be a problem. The other thing is that historically the Thai groups were incredibly fractious. They differed on goals and ideology. You had secular groups, you had ethno-nationalist groups, you had groups that wanted to be part of Malaysia, some groups that wanted autonomy in Thailand, some wanted an independent state, some wanted an independent Islamic state. They could never cooperate. Right now, what we're seeing is unprecedented degree of cooperation. And one of the reasons they're cooperating is the few groups that are out there actually have a shared Islamist agenda. And I'm very concerned. Their technical capacity has gone up dramatically. I'm somewhat encouraged by these recent offers of peace talks, but I'm still skeptical because the group jumping up and down and saying, we'll negotiate, come to us, is actually the group that doesn't control any of the the events on the ground. There are mainly a group of aging exiles living in Europe and Damascus. This is important because you had a very similar thing with Aceh, with Gam. And one of the reasons the leadership of Gam was willing to cut a deal was when President Yudhoyono came in. He said, I'm not dealing with them anymore. I'm going to the people on the ground. And then they were able to cut some sort of deal. It wasn't just the tsunami. And so these people, whether they're in Stockholm or they're sitting in Kuala Lumpur or in Damascus, they're at least channels, because the coup leader, General Sunti, I've met him before, he'll come out and say, we don't know who's behind it. We know the organizations, but in terms of personnel, he said, we really don't know who's behind it. So at least if you go to some of these groups that are appearing in the public, they will be conduits. I hope that something can be negotiated, but right now I don't see any incentive for the insurgents to negotiate, simply because they control the day down south. They're attacking at will. The government's made almost no meaningful arrests. There have been 700 arrests, but those 700 arrests have basically angered several thousand more people. So, I mean, this is a problem that we've got to address in the coming years.
So I'll be very brief. We could have gone on. Dr. Boozer is, you will recognize, is very much an expert in the field. It's a very important field, both internationally, but particularly for us Australians who are directly involved in the area. We thank you for your paper today. There's also an article in the opinion page of Today's Australian, which will follow up some of the details in the talk. It'll be great when Anne runs your paper in the Sydney papers from here tonight, and I'm sure you'll be back at the Sydney Institute some time in the future. But this is the start of your Australian visit. Thanks also to AJ, Colin Rubenstein and Robert Kleinert. This has been the start of your Australian visit. It's been a great commencement, and best wishes for the following week.
To come here where there's real interest.
We want you to have fun. We want you to have fun in Australia.
You know, they keep on booking me in places like this. Like, I keep on asking them, couldn't we have a talk in the Barossa Valley? Or...